to Distanced, a podcast about people around the world who are dealing with life in quarantine during the age of the coronavirus. I'm your host, Sunil Rajaraman, and I'm recording from my home in San Mateo, California. Thanks, everyone, for joining today's episode of Distanced. I'm trying to give you a tour from around the country and around the world, and today's stop is Boston, Massachusetts. And I had the pleasure of interviewing today Alex Sheng, who is a doctor at Boston Medical Center. And Boston Medical Center is famous for being the busiest ER in New England and the eighth busiest in the entire country. And Alex is literally seeing the sickest of the sickest patients right now who are dealing with, you know, the very tragic situation with coronavirus. And I met Alex through a mutual friend, Joanne, and we immediately hit it off. And I admire everything he's doing right now to help patients make it through this difficult period. And there were some pretty interesting insights in this interview. So for those of you who are curious to see how New England is handling the whole crisis, you'll get some tidbits there. But Alex gets into some pretty significant details in how patients react to the virus and what he's forced to do if cases get severe. So there is some heavy content in this, but mostly I want you to walk away with the feeling that people like Alex, you know, have our backs during this difficult time. So I hope you enjoy today's interview. Hey, Alex, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. I mean, I'm sure you've had a much more intense day than I have.
Actually, it's I did work today. So I work in the emergency department, and it's a little bit of a quiet before the storm, I feel like. We kind of had a chance to kind of prepare a little bit here in Boston compared to the other places that are a little more harder hit, like New York and Seattle. So, you know, with the governor and the mayor asking for folks to social distance, there's actually less volume in the ER, but I think people are generally sicker overall with their breathing problems and from the COVID.
So we just got right into it, and we're going to take a step back for a second here. And
sure.
I've done an intro for this so people will know a little bit about who you are, but for people just listening to this for the first time, if you can just share where you are, what you do, what your life situation is like, and any other background info that could be helpful.
Yeah, totally. So I grew up in North Carolina in the suburbs, and I went to University of North Carolina for school, go Heels. I moved to Boston 10 years ago, where I now work as an emergency physician at the busiest emergency department in New England, Boston Medical Center. And supposedly the eighth busiest in the nation, but it's not like I'm seeing every single patient. It's just when it's a busier hospital, there's more staff. So I can't take all the credit.
And do you live in a house, in an apartment, in a condo? Do you have family, et cetera?
Yeah, my wife and I live in a little two bedroom, one bath, Cape style house in built in the 1930s. In Belmont, Massachusetts, and pretty much all the houses up here are pretty old and have weird oil tanks and no central air, and ours is pretty typical.
And do you like Boston? I mean, so you are from North Carolina. I mean, the obvious answer to that is going to be yes, since a lot of people are going to listen to this, but maybe I should ask, why do you like Boston?
Yeah, I like Boston. Coming from the suburbs, Boston was a pretty easy transition. It's a kind of a considered a city, but it's really more of a small town, much like San Francisco in a way. It's very manageable, walkable, good public transportation. So those are the reasons. Like, there's good restaurants and generally a pretty city to live in. It's expensive. It's cold. So those are the minuses, I guess.
What? Where are your sports teams from? Are you a sports guy?
Yeah, I am. So I follow the UNC basketball, and that's kind of my diehard person. And I'm more of a fair weather fan when it comes to Boston sports, because they call Boston the city of champions, because between the Celtics and Bruins and the Red Sox, and the Patriots. It's not uncommon that we have championships up here, but considering I live right by Fenway, I had a little bit of a love and hate relationship with the Red Sox. When they were doing well and there were games, there was every single subway was completely full, jam-packed, and I couldn't get to work. So,
well, not
you know,
to
at the game,
not to do too much of the gallows humor, but I mean the one benefit of everything shutting down is everybody's forgetting about the Major League Baseball crises, and it was looking like, yeah. I mean, obviously Houston was implicated pretty heavily, but if I'm not mistaken, Boston was either about to be or did to some extent get implicated.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I haven't actually followed super closely this season, so we all have our attentions elsewhere.
And speaking of attention elsewhere, I mean, you know, we don't have sports as a distraction, and we're all kind of suffering through this extremely weird period, but, you know, you have a very unique experience going through this. And so have you ever in your career even come close to experiencing something like we're experiencing right now? Is there any kind of analog that you can draw that would be like, whoa, it was sort of like this, but much worse, or is this just its own thing?
Yeah, no, this is his own thing. I was in medical school when kind of the Middle Eastern virus and SARS was hitting, those type of years. I was still in training at the time in residency. And even though, you know, you're watching the news and you're kind of somewhat concerned about it, really didn't hit us as hard. Ebola was definitely a wake-up call because people who got it had like a 50% mortality. So, you know, it's really dramatic, and the mortality rate was so much higher, but luckily, you know, it wasn't very easy to transmit to other people. So we had everything prepared in terms of protective equipment, getting ready for potential influx and spread of the disease in the US, but fortunately that did not happen. So
was there a moment where, you know, you thought to yourself, okay, this is the thing that I read, or this is the news that I was watching when I knew that this was going to be a problem and affect me? Was there a moment like that for you?
With coronavirus?
Yep.
I think a lot of it is firsthand experience. And I remember within probably a period of a few days, I went from reassuring the worried well, and at that time there was no, it was fairly recently, even a few weeks ago, there was no testing really available. So we were reassuring the worried well, and then within days, every test I ran was positive, and we were intubating really sick folks in respiratory distress, and they were really having a hard time. So.
And, you know, like, what is the magnitude that just someone like you individually, you know, sees? I know you can't speak for like hospital systems in general, but is it like, I'm just trying to think, is it dozens of people? Is it tens of people? Is it hundreds of people that you're seeing on a daily or weekly or whatever basis that could be corona patients? Or like, what's the magnitude?
So I guess before the coronavirus, I would see anywhere from like 20 to 40 patients during an 8-hour, 30 patients, maybe 20 to 30 patients in an 8-hour shift. Now the volume has gone down because of the social distancing, and a lot of people don't want to come to the hospital with the potential that they might catch the virus. So the volume generally has gone down, but I would say see probably at least 5 to 10 coronavirus positive patients during a shift. Some I discharge, and some I admit to the hospital, and probably a handful, maybe less than a handful, who are really sick going to the ICU, and I'm wondering why should I intubate them now, or they're going to be intubated, you know, shortly up to, on the in the ICU.
Can you? And so I look. I'm like a lot of people. I follow media and I read about stuff, and I'm reading the Boris Johnson stuff today. I don't know if you saw the UK Prime Minister.
Yeah, poor guy's not as jovial as normal, huh?
No, I guess not. Yeah, and it's just, yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. But what is intubation? Like, can you just explain that word? Like, what exactly happens when you're intubated?
Yeah, so as of right now there's no single proven drug of choice for, I know there's a lot of different therapies that appear promising and they may very well be helpful. The only thing we can do for this disease process is to support the patients through it. If they were, you know, not eating, not drinking, they might need a little bit of fluid, if they may need a little bit of support in terms of their symptoms. But the really feared complication of the coronavirus is that it affects both your lungs, kind of throughout the lungs, causing a lot of fluid buildup, inflammation, and patients can get really short of breath. Their oxygen levels can go down, and really, because our concerns for the virus getting aerosolized with some of the other therapies that we can potentially use to support their breathing, at least right now, the only thing we can do when they're in really severe distress is to put a breathing tube down into their trachea or their breathing airway is what we call it, and put them to sleep, and then put them on a breathing machine is what the general folks call it.
That sounds just horrifying.
Or a ventilator.
And you know, am I to assume that in general, it's a small percentage of people that reach that point, or with this virus, is it like a large number of people? I know volume-wise, you know, that's a lot of the talk right now, shortage of ventilators and all of that. But
definitely
on a percentage basis, is this 20% of people? Is this 50%? Like, I know we're just swagging at numbers, but order of magnitude. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think the numbers change every day, but so far about 20% of folks do end up needing to get admitted to the hospital. Fortunately, 80% have mild or very little symptoms or no symptoms even. And out of that 20%, maybe about one third or so, I would probably venture out to guess, end up getting intubated having that breathing tube in their airway and then getting put on a ventilator.
That's scary.
It is, because, well, for me, I'm seeing the folks who are really could not stay home. They felt so unwell that they had to come in. And so I'm kind of seeing a selective population. So that's why it seems especially scary to me. I don't see the folks that get better that often. I have some friends who work in the ICU who say, you know, took them off the ventilator. They're doing well. It's very hopeful. And unfortunately, I don't get to see that end of it.
I mean, that's still the selection bias of people who must be just coming to see you, they must be the sickest. And then if they're going to the ICU, yikes. So, you know, curious to know, I mean, how do you stay healthy? Or do you just assume at this point you're going to get the virus? And what's your mindset? Like, how are you thinking about that for yourself personally?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there's, most physicians who work on the front lines and, first responders, nurses, and really anyone who helps us in this, tough time, even, housekeeping and pharmacists and PAs, everybody, like, I think a lot of us assume we're going to get the virus. We try our best to put on as much personal protective equipment as possible that are available. And so our hospital has generally supplied us fairly well with the N95 masks. Those are the really tight, uncomfortable masks that you wear. That's supposed to filter out a lot of smaller particles, as opposed to the yellow surgical masks that are more loose-fitting and more comfortable. So we have that. I wear goggles. We have a face shield. I usually have a gown as well. And when I go into patients' rooms, gloves, and there's specific procedures for how to put these personal protective equipment on and how to take it off in the right order to minimize the exposure. Obviously, wash your hands well, not touch your face, and you must do the best you can.
I mean, it's unbelievable what you have to do every day. I mean, as a frontline worker, I mean, as a normal citizen, like when I do takeout, you know, I freak out, right?
I get takeout too, so I hear you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like, oh, okay, oops, you know, I went to In-N-Out. Yeah. I kind of accidentally touched the person's finger when I was grabbing the bag. And, you know, that's a that's a moment of panic. But you and people like you are just constantly exposed to this stuff. And I'm just curious, like, I mean, how do you get up for this every day mentally? I mean, is it, like, how are you doing? Is it like, are you just kind of whatever, you're numb to it? Like, it's just, you view it as part of your job. What's your mindset?
I do think it's part of my job, honestly. And if I was a lot older and if I had a lot of significant medical problems, I would potentially consider it a far more higher risk than I do now. And young people, unfortunately, are still getting sick and can potentially be potentially can die from this as well, but fortunately a much lower rate. I do weigh the benefits and the risks between myself and obviously discussing it with my wife, and I don't get to see my elderly parents anymore because I don't want to get them sick. So it's just weighing a lot of the benefits and risks, and obviously the benefit is the huge upside of, and especially, you know, with the orders to self-isolate, like I wouldn't know what to do if I wasn't working. I would be pretty, it's a good way for me to feel like I'm chipping in.
How does your wife handle it? Like, does she worry? Does she tell you, you know what, maybe you should just take a day off, it's totally cool? Or is she kind of acting as a supporter? What's her mindset?
Yeah, I mean, one of the considerations we had at the beginning was whether we should even, you know, like, she's always been supportive of my work. That is not an issue. But whether I should social distance with her at home. We know that a certain percentage of people don't have symptoms, even if they're carriers of the virus. So from my standpoint, considering I'm in contact with presumed positive or known positive coronavirus patients and a lot of high-risk staff as well, I was pretty open to, like, just living out of the basement or getting a hotel during this time. But, you know, obviously it could be weeks, many months. So my wife and I discussed this pretty extensively, and she pulled the plug and she said just simply we weren't going to do that, and just too long of a time to be apart. Fortunately, she's generally healthy as well. So we kind of take everything into account.
And is she in a different profession? Is she in the medical profession, or does that add to her understanding, or what's her background?
She's a hospice social worker, so she's definitely in healthcare, and she has a pretty good understanding of the risks.
And does that, in your mind, you know, add an element of risk from the standpoint? I mean, obviously she's dealing with a very, very sick. Is that an additional risk? Or, I mean, at this point, it's just like you've taken every precaution, so you're just doing the best you can.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly don't want to get her patients sick because they're even more vulnerable. So she actually just got tested today, even though she had no symptoms, just to make sure she came in contact with someone a couple of weeks ago. But one of the things she makes me do this whole ritual when I get home, I, you know, go through the garage entrance only. I leave the shoes outside, and I come in and throw all my clothes in the laundry, run basically buck naked upstairs for a shower right away. While she disinfects everything in my path, doorknobs, light switches, everything. So, I mean, I don't know. Hopefully that will reduce some of the risk, but those are some of the unique things that we're doing.
That's unbelievable. And I'm sure it's going to continue on like this for a while. You mentioned, you know, she got tested. I'm just curious, for healthcare workers, is there some sort of like baseball, like mandatory, you know, drug testing or whatever for frontline workers? Is there mandatory testing, or how do you, you know, like, and would it even matter if you got tested all the time?
Yeah, there's no mandatory testing. I think different institutions might have different requirements of taking your temperature in the morning or twice a day, but ours does not. And the only reason she got tested was she had a positive contact at work, and we didn't want to run any risks with her infecting her patients.
It really, you know, and I'm, you know, the testing, I'm seeing all sorts of stuff. I'm hearing it's getting better. And I read the news and I see this stuff about five minute tests. Is that a reality? Is that happening? Like, I just have no knowledge of, you know, of how tests are evolving in these past few weeks.
Yeah, it's evolving very quickly. I think even probably, let's see, about a month ago, we barely had any testing at any of the hospitals in Boston. And now we have not only, at that time, we had to send everything to Department of Public Health, which gets shipped in other states. And the results would take anywhere from 3 days to a week or even longer. And now we're at the point where we not only have in-house tests within the hospital that come back within, you know, a day or two, but we're starting to get ones that come back within a couple of hours. So that's going to help a lot.
That's amazing. I mean, just a few weeks ago, I know, right? And so, like, I'm trying to maintain my optimist hat here. One of the things I love about this country, not to get sort of overly patriotic, but I know that there's different approaches different countries have taken, and, you know, China took their approach, which is probably not realistic in the U.S. But, you know, on the flip side of that, you know, everyone has a voice, and someone like you can come on here and talk about stuff, or you can go on Twitter and you can see people complain about the way things are, sure, you know, going, and you get an immediate sort of reaction from people who want to work to solve the problem, or someone like a Bill Gates, and, you know, sort of, yeah, all of this. Definitely. And so I do appreciate about that, about this place. But, you know, on the other sort of testing question I had is, I keep hearing stuff about antibody tests, and what do you know about that, if anything?
I don't know of anything that's established protocols about that, but the idea is that once you've had been infected with a virus at some point in the past, your body will have antibodies that stay with you for potentially years, or even sometimes for the rest of your life. Depending on the disease process. So it'd be nice to know if someone had been infected previously and that they've recovered. Not only, you know, I'm optimist as well. So if we later find out that a much greater population has already been infected and has recovered, we would potentially, from a large epidemiologic percentage standpoint, the risk of people getting sicker and the risk of mortality would be actually lower than we think, because so far everyone getting tested are generally people at risk, people who are really sick, feeling unwell. It'd be nice to expand the denominator to a point that we can maybe feel a little bit better, not that it's not a terrible disease as it is. I'm not sure when that will be coming out, but I bet it will be sometime soon, because also another benefit of the antibody test is we can get people back to work, not only in front lines of healthcare, but just back to working their normal jobs, back to the economy, and contributing to recovery.
Now, I haven't been following the progress with Boston since I'm here based in the Bay, and, you know, I look at all the COVID trackers and all of that, and the stats that I read, and, you know, as a hack, kind of show that we are making some progressing thanks to social distancing and reducing the rate of cases coming in every day, at least in the Bay Area. Is that the case? Like, I just have no knowledge of Boston or New England. Is that also what you're seeing, or is it still kind of going up? Like, what's the feeling over there?
The feeling is that we are we're expecting to see a peak within the next couple of weeks. So far, I think we're the top 6th or 7th in the country in terms of cases. And if we're hitting our peak within the next couple of weeks, it'd be nice to see a decrease in number of cases and mortality.
That would be amazing. And how is, just in your opinion, how is, you know, the East Coast doing with, and actually Boston specifically, with social distancing? Like, if you were to walk out on the street, are people doing a good job of it? Or, you know, how, like, just what describe the scene over there right now?
We see pictures across the nation of just these dead streets in huge metropolitan areas. Honestly, I've yet to see that yet in Boston. We have orders to social distance, but I see you know, one of the benefits of this, I guess, this terrible thing is that the traffic has been non-existent. But still, there's a, you know, some cars on the road on a regular basis when I go to work, when I come back from work. So I feel like, you know, hopefully they're essential workers, but I'm sure some are not. So I think we have some room to improve, but I think a lot of people are adhering to the recommendations.
And yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it's like pretty similar to the Bay Area. I'm just trying to paint a picture for people. I mean, for us, it's been fairly empty streets. I live in a suburb outside of San Francisco called San Mateo, and sure. You know, in the neighborhood, people do walk, but it's pretty respectful. There's not
right.
crowding and things like that. And obviously, all the businesses are shuttered. Grocery stores, when you go there, you have the long lines with the 6 feet of distance that, you know, they kind of regulate traffic. Is that just pretty similar to what you're seeing, or is it slightly different, would you say?
Yeah. So earlier I was talking more about the traffic, but yes, when, you know, I go for a walk or take out the garbage and I do see people walking outside, they do respect the distance quite well. Yeah, the supermarket is exactly what you described. People are keeping their distance. People are still going to Costco a lot. I mean, people still need deals. So there's still a good amount of people there, but they're definitely at least 6 feet of them.
And obviously the Bay Area is a very like delivery centric culture. You know, all the on-demand stuff came yeah. here. Is that a thing in Boston, or are just delivery workers? And, you know, they're another obviously essential frontline worker.
Absolutely.
And, you know, are people using those services even more so, or how would you describe that?
I'm not sure if getting a sense of what other people's doing in terms of delivery has been, I'm not sure about that, actually. I haven't really asked too much about that for other people, but for us, we still get deliveries of things we order online, and it's been both expeditious and really appreciated. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm curious, just as a healthcare worker, right? You have the people like me who are the really, really paranoid people who, oh my gosh, you know, I'll think twice before ordering delivery and all of that. Is that just not something you think about? Is that, you know, like, I mean, of all the things you have to stress about, I'm sure the last thing you're worried about is that. But like, just how do you? What are some tips for living for people who are paranoid like me that you might have?
You mean in terms of touching things that are delivered, things like that?
Yeah. And like, you know, so other kind of neuroses that I've developed. I mean, I wash my hands like literally just constantly. There's, you know, they get to the point where they're dry and like, you know, cracked. And you know, I take a Clorox wipe every night and I go around to, you know, sinks and microwaves and everything like that. And I just kind of give everything yep. a wipe down. Like, you know, and I just can't get myself to order groceries delivery and like wipe down every package. That's sort of like my my threshold. But you know,
yeah.
what are things that you do day to day, or that you would, you know, encourage people to do, or maybe some things not to stress about so much? I know that every case is individual, and you know, the disclosure is none of this should be interpreted as medical advice for our listeners. But
sure.
But I'm just yep, asking you.
Definitely. Yeah, so I think, you know, we don't get so much groceries from delivery. But if you need something badly, I think, you know, the general recommendation is to, you know, wipe down your grocery containers and wash your hands. But really, generally, most things you don't need very very quickly. You're okay without it for a few days. So generally, the virus stays on cardboard for about 24 hours, maybe a little bit longer. So if a package comes in, you don't need it right now, just leave it. No stress, put it in the corner. And then in plastic, generally about 3 days. So if you don't need it that badly, just any delivery comes in, you put it in a corner immediately, and then just leave it and forget about it. And then within a few days or a week, you don't have to worry about it at all.
That's, you know, that's good to know for people like me. And that's how I operate, right? It's like, you're exactly right. It's, you know, I like unpack the groceries. There's several things that I just won't use for days. And,
yeah.
You know, I wash my hands after I, you know, whatever, put them in the cupboards and all of that. But I'm trying, you know, everybody has sort of developed their own level of threshold of, you know, worrying about stuff. It's going to be really interesting just coming back, how behavior will change overall.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yeah. Do you have a take on that? Like, what are some predictions that you have that, you know what, this is happening, this is here to stay, no matter what? Like, do you have a few predictions?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, if the virus ends up being a seasonal, kind of a flu-like illness with this high of a mortality, generally the flu virus has about 0.1% chance of dying, so it's still significant for sure on a population level, and I'm sure individuals who are affected, but the coronavirus has a, you know, maybe a 2% mortality, so that's like 20 times higher. So if it becomes a seasonal thing, I don't think we're ever gonna, until we come up with a vaccine and a magic treatment, we're never gonna shake hands or hug or be able to do a lot of things that we're so used to because of this. But hopefully when we have a cure and a vaccine, it's still going to be a very slow recovery, and slowly getting used to gathering and being together and fist bumping and things like that.
You're a Boston guy, so I'll ask you a closing question, which is, when do you think the next time you'll be able to go to a game at Fenway is? If you had to predict a date.
Oh man, I'm an optimist, so I'm going to say the summer is such a great time for baseball, but it's probably going to be, I'm going to say August. We'll see what happens. But.
All right. Well, for the optimists out there, I'm hopeful for an August baseball game, and I am hopeful for football season as well. And, I'm a big sports guy. And so this has been like really, really hard to cope without the professional sports.
Yep. I bet. Yeah.
Anything closing that you want to, you want to say, any shout outs, before we end?
Yeah, no, I just want to say, you know, it's really not just, you know, we get a lot of credit as frontline healthcare workers. And I really appreciate that, but I think it's crucial to recognize those people who aren't always as well known, who are doing their part to fight this pandemic, our housekeepers, again, our, you know, like you said, the delivery drivers, the people who work at grocery stores, the truck drivers, really, and really just about everyone who keeps up the supply chain to keep us going. Fortunately, we still have a pretty robust, you know, system for supplies, groceries, and everyone can stay at home and still have, for the, you know, for most people, have things to eat and things like that. And really, for a lot of us who are, you know, having a tough time doing the social distancing thing at home, we're, you know, trying to get out and do things. There's a lot of you know, a lot of these, we're lucky enough to even have a place to stay and be able to social distance. There's a lot of people who lack the financial, social support and resources to even do that, living in close quarters, or people who have to be out of work. So a lot of things I feel like I deal with is kind of social problems, so it could be worse.
Well, we appreciate, you know, your selflessness during this time, but, you know, goes without saying that we appreciate you. So thanks for taking the time to talk to me so late. And this was super educational. We really appreciate you.
Thanks for the opportunity. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Alex Cheng. Alex is really kind of one of the brave heroes that we all talk about, we read about in the news. And there he is actually doing it. And I hope this gives you a taste of what it's like to be someone like him at this time. And what was remarkable about the whole interview to me is he just seems so calm and collected, and it seems like none of this affects him. And, you know, it's one of those things where you often deal with the reality with which you're presented and kind of process it as if it's, you know, just everyday life. thankful to have people like Alex working hard for us during this difficult time. Thanks for joining today's episode of Distanced. And if you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And follow me on Twitter at Subes01. That's SUBES01. Thank you.